Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called Imagery of Rebirth Yoga. It is the fourth selection in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. And now, Joseph Campbell.
In my first talk, I tried to suggest something of what seemed to me to be the function served by traditional mythology, saying also something of the way in which our own tradition has sort of slipped so that the communication is not as effective as it might be. And I tried also at that time to suggest something of the distinction between the Oriental and Occidental ideals of the life, the ideal life of the individual, first in relation to society, and then in relation to self-discovery. And then last evening, I was speaking principally about the difficulties when a tradition, as it seems to me is the case with ours, is not rendering its message, how one may fall away from this, and I took the phenomenology of schizophrenia as an example. Now, with the schizophrenic, you have a person drowning, so to say, in the ocean of the imagery of the instinct system. What I want to talk about today is the miracle of the person who knows how to swim in this. Now, when we come to the question of rebirth, the imagery of rebirth is of two main orders. That which is symbolized, so to say, in the moon, which dies and is resurrected, and is the chief symbol of this miracle of rebirth in time. The moon sheds its shadow as a serpent sheds its skin. And so the serpent plays a role also as a symbol of this same principle of the life which is reborn from its own death. The moon, the horns of the moon, are seen rendered in the horns of the bull. And so the bull in traditional mythologies also is associated with this symbology of death and rebirth. And the sacrificial bull, the sacrifice of the bull, is symbolic of the sacrifice of that mortal part in us which leads to the release of the eternal. Now, the other idea of rebirth is that of not coming back at all, not being reborn here, but passing beyond the spheres of rebirth altogether to a transcendent light. And the typical image for this is the sun. The sun is all light. The moon carries darkness within it. But wherever the sun goes, there is no darkness. There are only the shadows of those forces that do not open to its light. And so the image of the sun door speaks of another kind of rebirth, the return of the lost one, the one lost in the spheres of shadows and time, to that eternal root, which is his own great root. The animal symbolic of this, as the bull symbolic of the sun, of the moon, is the lion with his great radiant solar face. And as the sun rising quenches the moon and quenches the stars, so the lion roar sends the grazing animals scattering, and the lion pouncing on the bull, which is a motif that you'll see in primitive art, particularly in the Middle East, in Persian art, is symbolic of this business of the sun rising and quenching the moon. In contrast to the serpent, we have the eagle, which is the solar bird. And so we have these parallels, eagle against serpent, lion against bull, sun against moon. The great mythological figures of the early mythologies of the vegetal rebirth of life every year, coming back, such figures as Tammuz, Adonis, and Osiris are associated primarily with the bull symbol. But when we come to a figure like the Buddha, who represents the transcendence of all reincarnation whatsoever, we have the lion symbol. And if you look at the Buddha thrones in the art of India, you'll see it is a lion throne. And the Buddha's message is said to be the lion roar. Now, what I want to talk about today is how to learn to roar like a lion. The great first text in yoga, the prime classical text, is called the Yoga Sutras, S-U-T-R-A-S. Sutras is a word related to the word suture, thread. When the doctor sews you up after an operation, it's a suture. That's the same root as our word, as the Sanskrit sutra. The Yoga Sutra is a kind of summary textbook of the main laws and principles of yoga. It's ascribed to a semi-legendary figure named Patanjali, who is, the Anjali is this posture. Pata means fall, and the name is said to come from the fact that when a great saint brought his hands together, this particular saint, Patanjali, fell in the form of a small serpent and was caught in the hands of the saint who became his guru. Now you can take that or leave it. The first aphorism of the Yoga Sutras is a definition of yoga, and I'll give this as an opening suggestion. Yoga is the intentional stopping of the spontaneous activity of the mind. The word is actually mind stuff, mind substance. Yoga is the intentional stopping of the spontaneous action or activity of the mind stuff. The notion is that within the gross matter of the mind, there is a subtle substance that takes the forms of what we experience. We see each other here because there is an echo in this substance in our minds which takes the forms of what we see and hear as well. And when you move your eyes quickly, you can see how rapidly this substance changes form. Now, the difficulty is that it will not stop changing form. Even when we want to rest in one thought, the mind goes rippling on. You can test it for yourself. Put your watch down and decide to hold in your mind one thought or one image for 15 seconds. And you will find that almost immediately you are having associated thoughts. You're not fixed on one thought. Now, the goal of yoga is to make this mind substance stop moving that way. And you may ask yourself, well, what is the point of this? The point is illustrated by analogy with the surface of a pond blown by a wind. When the pond surface ripples, and you look into it as though you were looking into a mirror, all you see are broken forms. The clouds above are not perfectly reflected. The trees round about are all broken up. And so it is when our mind is in movement, like the rippling surface of a pond, all that we see are broken images. But let the wind be still, and the water cleared of all sediment, and you will see perfectly reflected the forms which formerly had been only broken in your experience. And so it is when the mind is stilled in yoga. All these broken reflections, which we are gathered back to the image of which we are the broken reflections. And one sees not only the reflected sky, but also down into the water depths, down into the water depth of one's own being, and the image beheld then is the form of forms, that form which in all of us is broken. Now, when this is experienced, the fascination is completely absorbing. And it may be such that the one who beholds it would not wish to return to see the broken forms again. Then he remains in that fixed contemplation, and as they say, the body drops off. He has been returned to union with that which he indeed is. That which we call our ego, that which we think of as ourselves, is but the broken reflection of that which is our true selves. And the discovery of that true self is the recovery of union with our own being. The meaning of the word yoga, it is from a Sanskrit root yuj, which means to yoke something to something else, to yoke your daily waking consciousness to the radiant solar consciousness, which is called in the Buddhist tradition the Buddha consciousness. In the medieval period, early medieval period in India, a very richly interpreted and experienced system of yoga called the Kundalini yoga was developed. Kundalini means coiled up one, and it is a feminine noun. What it refers to is the spiritual energy of the individual, which is conceived of as a serpent biting its tail in the form of the Ouroboros at the root of the spine, so that the energy which ought to come up the spine and suffuse our whole being is lost to us. It is simply, as it were, in seed at the root of our body. And the goal of this yoga is to wake that serpent and carry it up the spine. Now, you've all seen pictures of yogis, and you know how the thing goes. One is supposed to sit in something like a lotus posture, in perfect balance, with meditating gaze just about at the plane of the nose, so that you're not distracted outward nor lost inward. And then you begin to breathe very regularly. The regular breathing settling and steadying the thoughts. You are to breathe in through the right nostril for a certain number of beats assigned by your guru, and imagine that breath is going right down the spine, clearing a channel. And then you breathe out after holding breath for a certain number of counts through the left nostril, imagining the breath is coming up through the left side of the spine. And then you breathe in through the left nostril and so forth. While this is going on, that breath is suffusing the body, actually changing the chemical systems a little bit, something like what LSD does, and activating the serpent. Now the serpent starts up. There are, from root of the spine to crown of the head, inclusive, 7 points. And at each of these points, which are called lotuses or wheels, there is a transformation of the whole personality and psychology of the individual practicing this yoga. In the last century, there was a very great yogi whose name was Ramakrishna, who was a sort of virtuoso in bringing the Kundalini serpent up the spine. And his devotees would say to him, "Oh master, how is it when the Kundalini comes up the spine? How does it feel?" Well, he says, "Sometimes it feels like a mouse scampering up. Sometimes it's like a monkey jumping from branch to branch." And as he comes to these lotuses which are hanging limp, as they're touched, they open and they shimmer and shine. Then they would ask, "Oh master, how is it at the second center, the third, the fourth, the fifth?" And as he would get up toward the sixth and seventh, he would go into ecstasy and pass out and not be able to say very much about it. Now, not being a yogi, but only a scholar, I'm going to be able to tell you what goes on as you go up the 7 chakras. And that's my purpose this evening, this afternoon. The first chakra at the root is called Mula Dhara, M-U-L-A, D-H-A-R-A, which means root base. At this level, the energy, the spiritual energy, is simply, as they say, gripping, holding. It has no joy, it has no ecstasy, but it won't give up. This is just sheer being hanging on to being. I think, when I think of this, as a kind of dragon. Dragons, you know, we have a good deal of biology and zoology about the dragon. We know their habits. The dragon tends to guard things, and he usually has these guarded in a cave. And when you take a kind of count of what he tends to guard, it happens to be either beautiful girls or gold or both. Now, dragons don't know what to do either with beautiful girls or with gold, but they just hang on. And that's... there are people like this. We call them creeps. Now, the second chakra, this is called Svadhisthana, her favorite resort. You must know that this serpent is a female serpent. It represents energy. And in the Indian system, the active, energizing principle is regarded as female. And the languid one, the one that wants just to be let alone, is the masculine. Now, this active female serpent is on the way up to join her spouse in the lotus at the crown of the head. The second lotus, then, is called her favorite resort, and this, as you will probably have guessed, is at the level of the sex organs. At this level, one's whole psychology is Freudian. All the aims of one's life are really symbolic of one's sexual desire. And all of one's frustrations are interpreted in these terms. So that on the level of the second chakra, we can say Freudian psychology is perfectly acceptable. That's okay at this level. The third chakra is called Manipura, which means the city of the shining jewel. And this is at the level of the navel. I don't know whether you were about very much this summer, but I had the notion that this was the year of the Manipura. At the level of the navel, the whole aim of life is to consume things, to ingest it, to make it your own. This is the level of the will to power, the will to dominate, the will to win, or Adlerian psychology, or the Nietzschean will to power. Now, according to the Indian view, these three first chakras are the chakras on which normal human life and history are based. These are the urges that govern life outward directed. All the aims of life, all the fulfillments of life are the result of outward directed energies and actions. These are the levels of what are thought of as natural, materially oriented man. And now we come to the fourth chakra, which is at the level of the heart. You know, in religion, the heart is the important level. It is here, as they say, that the devotee's hands touch the feet of the Lord. This is the point of first meeting with the religious mystery. The experience of life on the first three levels has really no valid religious claims. It's only at this level that this begins. And the name of this chakra is Anahata, A-N-A-H-A-T-A. That literally translated means not hit. What it means is the sound that is not made by two things striking together. All the sounds that we hear are made by two things striking together. My voice, the sound of the air striking the laryngeal cords. Now, what is the sound that is not made by two things striking together, which is heard when the kundalini reaches the fourth chakra? This is the sound of the energy of which the world is a precipitation. It is antecedent to things. As we know now from our modern physics, the material world is a precipitation of energy. The atom explosions have proven that. And matter is simply, as it were, solidified energy. Well, the energy antecedent to the apparition of matter has a sound. And that is the sound that is not heard by not made by two things striking together. And what is that sound? That sound is Om. Now in Sanskrit, the syllable Om, the sound O, is analyzed into two sounds, A and U joined, A, U, M. So you'll sometimes see this written O-M and sometimes A-U-M. When written A-U-M, it is called the four-letter sound. I'm going to explain what the four letters are. When you pronounce this syllable, ah starts in the back of the mouth. Oo, the sound fills the mouth cavity, and then m, it closes at the lips. You move the sound mass forward. All words, therefore, are simply fragments of om. This includes all the sounds of all words. Consonants are regarded simply as stops. All the vowel sounds are included in om when it's properly pronounced. Thus, all the words and their meanings, all the sounds that we hear, are broken inflections of om, just as we are all broken inflections of that one image. Om is the sound value of that image. Now it is allegorically interpreted as follows. Ah is associated with what is called waking consciousness. That's the state of most of us here. When consciousness is awake, what one sees seems to be separate from oneself. Subject and object are separate from each other. The bodies that we behold are gross bodies, made of gross matter, called sthula, which changes form very slowly and is not self-luminous. It has to be lighted from without in order to be seen. On this level, Aristotelian logic prevails. A is not B. U is associated with dream consciousness. Now, when you move into the level of dream consciousness, all the laws of logic change. There, although you think you're seeing something that's not you, it is actually you that you're seeing, because the dream is simply a manifestation of your own will and energy. You created the dream, and yet you're surprised by it. So the duality there is illusory. There, subject and object, though apparently separate, are the same. Now, the realms of the gods and demons, heaven, purgatories, and hells, are of the substance of dream. The gods are of the substance of dream, so that the mythology of the world is the dream of the world. And if taken objectively, as though there were gods, well, then they are the counterparts of your dream. This is a very important point. Dream and myth are of the same logic. This is a point that we're getting in our psychiatric works now, from Freud, Jung, and Eric Fromm, and so forth. Now, since the subject and object seem to be separate but are not separate in a dream, so the God that seems to be outside of you is not different from you. You and your God are one. Now we're moving to something very interesting. All the heavens and gods are within you and are identical with aspects of your own consciousness on the dream level. Now we come to the M. This is the level of deep, dreamless sleep. Here, consciousness has been covered over by ignorance, by darkness. This is the realm out of which consciousness then will reappear. But the fact that we are not conscious of it does not mean that it's not there. But it is not consciousness of anything. There are no differentiated things. It is called an undifferentiated mass of consciousness. The goal of yoga is to go into that realm of undifferentiated consciousness awake. And when one does, what is there experienced is undifferentiated consciousness. We don't have a counterpart to this concept in our Western vocabularies. It doesn't even have a name in India. It's called simply the fourth state, and that is the letter of the fourth syllable. I mean, the fourth letter of the syllable, the letter of silence. Because all the words that we speak refer either to waking images and logic, dream images and logic, or ignorance. We do not have words for this, and so it is the ultimate silence, but it is that which we are. Now, the whole aim of Oriental religions, in contrast to ours, is to bring about in us an experience of our identity with that void, which is no void. It is beyond all description. That which is true being and mystery of all things is beyond naming, beyond imaging. So that any name or image that pretends to be the name or image of the ultimate divine thing is a false name and image. It is an idol. The goal of these religions is to help us to realize that that being which is beyond transcendent of definition is our own being. And you can take anything, any object, and regard it in that dimension of its mystery. You can take any object, put a ring around it, and regard it not in its system of relationships as serving a purpose, as made of certain substances, but just in its mystery as being, and the mystery of the being of this watch is identical with the mystery of the being of the universe. So any stick or stone can be taken as a basis for mystery contemplation. The goal then of these religions is to bring about a realization of this identity of yourself with that which comes as an experience. Now, to set our own position against this, the normal position in the West, we say God created the world, and God and the world are not the same. Creator and creature are not the same. So our religions do not strive for the experience of identity. In fact, that experience is the prime heresy in the West. Our religions intend the rendition of a relationship, the relationship of that which is not God to God. And this relationship is achieved through participation in what is taken to be God's chosen society, or the founded church. In the Hebrew tradition, God has a covenant with a certain people, and the relationship to God is through membership in that group. In the Christian tradition, Christ is true God and true man, which is regarded as a mystery here. In India, everybody is true God and true man, and the whole goal of the religion is to realize that divinity in yourself. So here we have an intention that is very different from anything we conceive of in our religious traditions. When you have heard this sound of God, this sound of the divine in all things, it is absolutely everywhere. You are fascinated by that. And this, properly, in the Orient, is the sphere of art. It is the rendition of that sound, that radiance, through whatever is contemplated. That is what art is about.